We're at the intersection of science fact and fiction.
Computer, I want a Klingon batleth, tip to tip 116 centimeters, weight 5.3 kilos, with an exterior hand gripping diameter of 5 centimeters. Blades, composite bacchanite.
Ah, a warrior's configuration. Now, what are you going to do with it?
I'm going to fight you.
And if my hand should slip and you should die?
Your hand would never slip. Unless you become old and feeble. Come on, Koloth. Surely you can take me down.
That's right. This week's intersection of science, fantasy, and reality brings us to Star Trek and the material Bakelite, which is a key ingredient in the weaponry of Klingons. And here to tell us about it, their swords of honor, otherwise known as batleths, and here to tell us about it is Duncan McGilvery, who's a McDonald's Institute Principal Investigator and Associate Professor at Auckland University. Kia ora, Duncan. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian. Good to be talking to you.
Bakelite and the batleth. Was I saying that more or less right?
More or less right. I mean, one of the things, so I chose this because I was really interested. I quite enjoy Star Trek, and what I've discovered is while I really enjoy Star Trek, I'm not a Trekkie. So that's a pretty good effort, but there are those out there who have learnt Klingon and could do it probably much better than either of us.
Tell us a bit more about the substance.
So bakelite is a strong reinforced metal which, you know, it's primarily used to make these special swords, the batleth. And the batleth, these swords, are probably one of the most iconic images for Klingons. They're a really huge, curved, spiky-looking, two-handed sword that they use because they're incredibly strong. And they're really impressive-looking and scary-looking things.
In the science fiction of Star Trek, what's special about these swords?
It's all to do with the cosmology of the Klingons. The Klingons have this as a really sacred object, based off the original sword, the Sword of Kaleth, a really iconic sword that Kaleth forged by taking a lock of hair from his own head, dipping it into the lava volcano, quenching it in a sacred lake and then twisting it into the shape of a sword. So it's all tied up into this mythology of the Klingon people. A very, you know, symbolic material, really important to them. The swords, you know, look terrifying. And they're probably really hard to use, although there are people who practice using them. You can get all sorts of nice videos of people pretending to use them.
In fact, wasn't a Trekkie arrested in the street somewhere in Britain for wandering around with one of these swords and brandishing it about?
Absolutely, because they are swords and they're, you know, quite lethal weapons. And I imagine if you were using it the way they're used in the TV shows, you could do quite a lot of damage with them. People are decapitated with a single blow. So, yeah, they're really nasty weapons. In terms of what makes them up, the bakelite, the material we're talking about, we don't have that much to go on. Appears to be fairly heavy. Appears to be fairly strong, and obviously appears to be fairly sharp, but it doesn't glow. It's not a magic material. It's not like a lightsaber. So in my kind of deep dive to understand what's going on there, I really sort of entered the world of Trekkies more than the world of Klingons, and it's really fascinating how people have taken this to heart and tried to work out more about it.
I mean, it sounds at first glance, or looks at first glance, like steel. Can't be that simple, surely.
It might actually be that simple. So what do we know about bakelite? It's only really mentioned in any kind of detail once, in one episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Blood Oath episode, Season 2, Episode 19, if anybody wants to go and look it up.
But you're not a Trekkie, Duncan.
But I'm not a Trekkie, honestly.
Yeah, that's right. I'm into trains, but I'm not a spotter, Duncan, so we're even.
Very similar, yeah, because people can take this to a very, very great depth. So there's one scene where one of the characters asks the computer to produce for them a Klingon buttless. Tip-to-tip, 116 centimetres, weight 5.3 kilos with an exterior hand-gripping diameter of 5 centimetres, blades made of composite bakonite. And that's a warrior's configuration. And that's it. That's kind of about all the detail we have. So then we start to think, well, what can you do with that to figure out what this bakonite is like? Is it really fictional, or is it just steel?
Well, how does it compare to your average run-of-the-mill medieval sword?
Yeah, so if you're a knight of the round table wielding Excalibur or something, from the research that's done on medieval swords, they're first of all nowhere near that heavy. You know, you see this in movies, people lifting these hugely heavy things, but in reality, if we do the studies on the swords that we have preserved, they kind of weigh about a kilo. You know, fluctuate a little bit, and if you're on the back of a horse wielding a really big one, it might weigh 2 kilos. So, you know, this buttless at 5 kilos is huge. It's pretty heavy.
Klingons are pretty solidly built, though, aren't they?
They are pretty solidly built. I think there's the muscle tone to go with it. And it's mostly used in ceremonial fights as well. I think it might be a bit different if you're walking around a medieval battlefield swinging your sword hour after hour. You probably don't want it to be too heavy.
So, no, and I mean, given that we're in Star Trek world, if you're wandering around fighting with a sword and everybody else has got, I don't know, quasi-nuclear weapons or laser weapons, then you're a bit of a sitting duck, aren't you?
Yeah, it's sort of bringing the knife to the gunfight, really. But, you know, this is part of the symbology and mythology. These are the weapons that were used before people were flying around in space. And sort of been preserved by the history. And, you know, we have some of that ourselves, even Olympic sword fighting. Sword fighting is not a particularly useful thing anymore, but in the right place, it'd be good to be skilled.
When knights in medieval times, I'm talking about the humans, were they using swords made of steel?
Yes. Yeah, certainly by medieval times. So steel has been known to humans for something like 4,000 odd years. In terms of sword making, you know, swords made from steel, you know, certainly in the last 2,000 years, Romans were using steel swords. So medieval knights absolutely were using steel swords. Nothing else really can hold the edge and be strong enough to be used in that kind of way.
What's
the real difference between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age was better swords.
Speaking of iron, what is the difference between iron and steel?
Not much. Not much chemically. Steel is mostly iron, but it's got about 2%, up to about 2% by weight of carbon added in there. So, you know, that tiny 2%, 2 grams per 100 grams of steel makes all the difference. It changes it from being soft, malleable, flexible iron, that's sort of like fencing wire, into something that is much more like a kitchen knife. Much stronger, holds an edge better, but also, you know, harder to work. So pure iron's quite soft. You can bend it and you can shape it reasonably easily, but that means it doesn't keep an edge, for example, whereas steel is a much harder.
Because I've always thought that carbon made steel more malleable and that iron on its own was heavy and brittle.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it all depends on the amount. And this is where it is a black art, and it's really an interesting thing. And this kind of brings us back a little bit to bakonite, because it's not exactly steel from what we can tell. Trying to figure out how this 5-kilo sword made of bakonite, what it's made of, involves people having to, you know, we know it's heavy, but it's heavy because it's big. They had to figure out how dense it is, which is how solidly packed the material is. People have been forging, creating, printing replica buttlets, and people have gone through to work this out from these replicas, how much they weigh, what their shape, how thick they are, whether they're strong enough. There's a huge amount of research in this to figure out that the bakonite is maybe 10% more dense than steel. So it's not quite steel. It's steel with a bit of something added in there.
See, it's a lot heavier than steel. These swords are much heavier. These buttlets are much heavier than your...
Much heavier than our ordinary swords, but that's mostly because they're much bigger than our ordinary swords as well.
But also they're much sharper.
They've got lots of pointy bits. They cut through things really well. You know, they're not a magic material. So it's conceivable that it's just a better steel. It's conceivable that they've figured out a little bit of something to add in there, or maybe something that occurred naturally in the iron ores that they had when they were making the steel in the first place, to make it just that little bit better.
What could that be in real life?
So, I mean, just take a really simple example. If you add 10% chromium to your steel, you get stainless steel, right? Quite a different material. Doesn't rust, you know, really long living, things don't stick to the surface. When we're looking at steels in the real world, one of the famous steels that people know quite a bit about is Damascus steel. This is the steel that has this really interesting watery pattern on the surface. And it was absolutely famous for making some of the most flexible, strong, and light swords you could imagine. So the art of making these super strong, light swords was lost, actually. And one of the reasons that it might have been lost, I mean, nowadays we can do a pretty good approximation of these ancient Damascus steel, but one of the reasons it might be lost was that it's the very special additives that they were using when they were making the steel, maybe not even intentionally, that gave it these interesting properties. A recent Nature paper, so Nature is the top journal for scientists. If I can publish my work in Nature, I'm extremely pleased. A recent article took apart one of these 1600s Damascus steel swords, took a tiny sample out of it, and put it under an electron microscope. And what they found was it had carbon nanotubes all the way through it. And they speculated that these carbon nanotubes might have come from the particular woods that they added into the forging when they were making the steel. So you've got to get the carbon from somewhere when you're changing iron to steel. One way to do that is to add plant matter, because it's mostly made of carbon. Maybe the particular plants they added, treated in a particular way, put carbon nanotubes. These are these really interesting carbon materials that are nanoscopically sized, so really, really tiny, but strong and flexible. Maybe that is what made the difference.
However, Damascus steel is kind of taking us in the other direction from the Barconite steel, isn't it? If we assume that Barconite is some kind of steel, do you think that's a reasonable assumption to make?
Look, honestly speaking, as a chemist, the periodic table doesn't matter where in the universe you are. So I start looking at something like Barconite and thinking, well, it's probably got to be made up mostly of the things that we've got on our periodic table. And iron is one of the most abundant materials in the universe. So I put my money that it was some kind of steel.
But Damascus steel is light, and your Bartleth swords are heavy, but very, very sharp.
The Damascus steel was light because they made them thinner, and they could get away with making them thinner because they were so flexible. So the heaviness of these swords is probably as much to do with the fact that the people wielding them were pretty strong. So they could have made a light sword, but they wanted to make a sword that had momentum behind it. And frankly, also looks really terrifying as well. I mean, you would want to get a fight with one of these guys. But they may have added something, a heavy metal in there that made it a bit stronger. And this is the thing. There aren't that many elements out there, but the subtle combinations, and as I say, 2% carbon, it's really not very much, completely changes the way iron behaves and turns it into steel. And if you add another thing as well, and you can play with the amount that you do it and the temperature you forge it at, suddenly you can get a huge range of properties without changing very much. It's really as much an art form as it is a science, because there are so many complex variables in there.
The way they wield it, does that give us any clues as to what it might be made of? Like, you don't use it like a lightsaber, do you?
No. A, it's too heavy, and B, it doesn't do the sorts of things that lightsabers do. It really, doesn't just slice through material very easily. If you bring in an overhead chop and you chop it down on somebody, it will cut into a human, no problem. It will decapitate somebody, no problem. But it's not going to slice through a wall in the way a lightsaber will. And it's usually a trade-off. The better something keeps an edge, the harder it is to give it the edge in the first place.
What do you think then, Duncan? Is it just steel? But from what you've told me, there's a lot of varieties of steel.
There's a huge variety of steel, trading off all sorts of things like strength, temperature resistance, ability to resist corrosion, cheapness to make. And it's not just about the composition, but it's also about the way they worked. And this is where the blacksmiths of the ancient eras had such standing in a community, because they had the ability to know what to mix, what temperatures to do it at, and how to treat it to get the result you want. So, you know, I would say it might not be steel, but it's something really similar to that. But that doesn't mean very much, because there are so many subtleties about how to do it. It's what makes it so fascinating.
Are there any other metals that could do what Bakelite does?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. You know, modern metallurgy works with a whole range of different materials. Steel is one of our most common things because iron is so cheap and abundant. But when we go to make aeroplanes, we're going super light. I actually don't know if we have a material that would do a better job than a high-quality steel to be sword-like.
Now, the key ingredients of steel are what? Iron and carbon. Those are the two elements that go right. So what? But as you point out, now, with the steel from Damascus, those Damascus swords, obviously the plant material is carbon too, am I right?
Yeah, so that's where they're getting the carbon from adding plant material in. But it will always contain other bits as well. So if you throw plant material in, yes, you'll mostly get carbon, but you will also get things like trace amounts of sodium, other metals that might be in the plant, and all of that can actually make a difference.
What do you think there might be in the steel of the Bakelite swords?
So it's coming out of a volcano. It could be all sorts of interesting things. Maybe it's something like depleted uranium. That would certainly add to the density. Certainly we use depleted uranium for bullets and shells that we really want to penetrate.
What is depleted uranium?
So uranium comes in radioactive form, one isotope that's going to be used in bombs and nuclear reactors, but most of the uranium comes in a non-radioactive form. So if you can take out the radioactive bits, which you probably want to do because you want to take those radioactive bits for your nuclear reactor, what's left behind is what we call depleted uranium. It's still uranium, but it's not very radioactive.
And its properties are?
Very heavy and dense. So it's still quite soft. It's not actually that useful by itself, but if you added a bit into steel, who knows what you could get. I don't think anybody's ever tried.
That's why people use it in weapons. They put it at the front of shells and bullets because it's so dense that it's going to barge through anything?
Exactly right. Got a bit of momentum behind it, so it's very hard to stop.
Is it possible that you could sharpen an edge on a sword made of steel and depleted uranium? Really, really, really sharp? But also be very strong?
So steel is still mostly iron, so yeah, I think it's possible. I don't know if that's going to be the one you try. There are so many different additives that you could add, other metals. You can add traditional ones that we use, who knows what the Klingons use, but things like manganese, nickel, tungsten, cobalt, niobium, all sorts of interesting things. Even small amounts of oxygen in there can make a difference. I think probably what you have is that volcano has a particular mineral composition that gave a really good result, and that's why you have to use that ore to get that material.
And depleted uranium is something you might find in lava?
Depending where you are, yeah, absolutely. It occurs, volcanoes are really great at stirring up whatever's underneath the surface of the earth, so if it exists, it could be there.
You mentioned before, well, I don't know, maybe it was me that brought it up, the old lightsaber. If a lightsaber was up against a Bakelite sword of Batleth, which one would cut through which?
ooh, Star Trek versus Star Wars. There's, there's huge fans.
I know. No, no. And you're not a Trekkie. Are you a Warsie?
I'm a little bit of both. But honestly, I think, you know, if I put those two fictional materials together, I put my money on the lightsaber. But at the same time, Klingons are pretty fierce people, so you would never bet on a Klingon losing.
You're not worried you're going to run into some trouble with real Trekkies about this? You're pretty confident you've... I mean, is this like the stir-up controversy? What do the fan sites say about what Baconite is made from?
Yeah, so the fan sites don't give us the details, because if they did, I would, of course, defer to the experts. They give the details of the swords and how the swords are used, and there's all sorts of ideas about the right way to use the swords and how strong the swords might be. I'm sure I've got something wrong. There is a well-defined Star Trek canon. You're not allowed to just make this stuff up. So I apologize right now to anybody who knows this much, much better than I do. As I say, I discovered that I like Star Trek, but I'm no Trekkie.
However, you can get these things 3D printed, can't you?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And kind of when Dax is saying computer produce this to me, it made me think this is something like 3D printing. So yes, you can get a printer to print a metal object like a sword. And, you know, it's still a technology that's a little bit of its infancy. So the strength of that sword compared to one that's being cast and forged in the old-fashioned way with rolling and beating and the like probably wouldn't hold up in a sword fight between the two. But we're just new at this. So it's entirely possible that we could end up 3D printing a sword like this that is super strong.
Then all you have to do is work out at the gym and be strong enough to wield it.
Yeah, and the skills to do so. As I say, it's the original story is that it's a hair that's been twisted after being dipped in lava. It really looks something like that. It does not look like a very efficient design for a sword.
Well, that must have been some head of hair if the hair survived the lava.
It's yeah.
No wonder Klingons are bald at the front.
Exactly, plucking out the hair trying to get the swords.
Duncan, thanks so much for joining us again.
Again, my pleasure.
Duncan McGilvery from the McDiarmid Institute with this week's, we have them every other week actually, our latest materials, fact or fiction. Tonight it was Baconite, a raw ingredient in swords. The swords are the Batleth, key cultural weapon for the Klingons.